Welcome to the Audio Digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for May of 2015. We'll discuss diagnostic and clinical challenges of narcissistic personality disorder. Our research includes two clinical trials of psychotherapy. One of them looked at interpersonal psychotherapy for PTSD, and another one tested brief cognitive behavioral therapy to reduce suicide attempts in military personnel with a previous history. A clinical trial of antidepressant medication compared the effects of different antidepressants on depressed women, but also looked at outcomes in the women's children. And children from a population-based cohort took part in an imaging study to see whether the neuroanatomical aspects of autism spectrum disorder lie on a continuum in the general population. This article has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll start the May highlights with our Treatment in Psychiatry feature about narcissistic personality disorder. Diagnosis can be confusing as the presentation is highly variable and there's a wide range of severity. In addition, there haven't been any randomized clinical trials of treatment, either psychotherapy or medication. Eve Caligor and colleagues present an approach to diagnosis and clinical management based on the literature and their own clinical experience. Comorbid disorders are common, and clinicians should obtain a thorough symptom picture and evaluate functioning in multiple settings. This can help in differential diagnosis, especially in patients with substance abuse, affective illness, anxiety, or interpersonal or work-related problems. Grandiosity is not the only presentation of narcissistic personality disorder. A vulnerable, covert subtype can be equally debilitating, and it's easy to miss. Diagnostic impressions can be shared with the patient in the context of psychoeducation and identifying treatment goals. It's difficult to collaborate on goals if the patient thinks he or she has a depressive disorder, while the therapist thinks the patient has a personality disorder but doesn't share that information. In characterizing narcissistic personality disorder for patients, focus on problems with self-esteem regulation, lack of satisfaction with interpersonal relations, and the subjective distress or functional impairment that brought the patient to treatment. Some patients may benefit from explicit discussion, but others find it injurious. They may do better with a more general discussion of phenomenology and disordered personality functioning. The grandiosity and defensiveness that often characterize narcissistic personality disorder can make it difficult to engage patients in any form of psychotherapy. Current treatment recommendations are based largely on clinical experience and theoretical formulations. Treatments based on psychodynamic formulations can be effective for some patients, according to case reports. Many of these focus on the relationship between therapist and patient in long-term psychotherapy. In the absence of empirically supported treatments for narcissistic pathology, it's common practice to use modified versions of treatments for near-neighbor disorders. Thus, patients with narcissistic personality disorder may be candidates for adaptations of empirically supported treatments for borderline personality disorder. In particular, Caligor and colleagues recommend mentalization-based therapy, transference-focused psychotherapy, and schema-focused psychotherapy. Dialectical behavioral therapy is an additional option for patients with comorbid borderline personality disorder and significant self-destructive acting out behaviors. All are longer-term treatments that require specialized training of practitioners. Patients with narcissistic personality disorder typically show impediments to beginning treatment and becoming engaged. The clinician can foster a treatment alliance by communicating empathy while focusing on specific treatment goals and monitoring his or her own internal reactions to the patient. The patient may more readily accept the clinician's comments if the clinician uses the patient's own words or begins with phrases such as you said earlier, clinicians' reactions to patients with narcissistic personality disorder tend to be powerful and negative. Therapists should try to maintain a non-judgmental, inquisitive stance. It's helpful to anticipate that one will have to monitor and contain one's own emotional reactions. Pitfalls to be avoided are to respond defensively, aggressively, or dismissively, or to withdraw and collude with the patient's denial of pathology through passivity. The therapist should attend to negative feelings the patient has about treatment and the clinician. If left unaddressed, these feelings pose a serious threat to the treatment. If they're addressed in an accepting, non-judgmental fashion, the discussion can help develop a treatment alliance. It can also lead to exploration of the patient's motivations for negative responses to others and to him or herself. For comorbid depression, anxiety, or substance abuse, adopt standard pharmacologic and psychotherapeutic interventions. Co-occurrence of narcissistic personality disorder complicates treatment, however. It increases the risk that the patient will drop out and makes it more difficult to establish and maintain a therapeutic alliance. The next study was a clinical trial of psychotherapy. John Markowitz and colleagues compared interpersonal psychotherapy with prolonged exposure in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. Exposure to trauma reminders has been considered imperative in psychotherapy for PTSD, but not all patients respond to exposure therapy, and most of them don't remit. Exposure therapy can also feel grueling for patients and therapists. Moreover, the complex PTSD picture contains a powerful interpersonal theme. So this trial was designed to see how interpersonal psychotherapy would measure up against prolonged exposure for PTSD, specifically whether it would meet criteria for non-inferiority. Relaxation therapy was also included as an active control condition. More than 100 patients with PTSD were randomly assigned to the three conditions. Interpersonal psychotherapy was adapted for PTSD, but addressed the interpersonal aftermath of trauma rather than the trauma itself. Weekly sessions were given for 10 weeks. The first half of treatment emphasized affective attunement, recognizing, naming, and expressing feelings in non-trauma-related interpersonal situations. The rest of the sessions focused on typical interpersonal problem areas. Symptoms were measured with the clinician-administered PTSD scale, or CAPS. Over the course of treatment, scores showed substantial symptomatic improvement in all three treatment groups. Compared with the control condition, relaxation therapy, prolonged exposure, showed a significantly greater reduction. The effect of interpersonal psychotherapy was close to that of prolonged exposure, and it met the criteria for non-inferiority. Interpersonal therapy didn't produce a greater reduction in symptom scores than the control condition, but on several other outcome measures, it showed an advantage. When response was defined categorically, according to a cutoff in the CAPS score, the rate of response was 63% for interpersonal therapy, and this was significantly higher than the rate for the control condition. Patients also completed a self-rating of symptoms. On this measure, patients in both the prolonged exposure group and the interpersonal therapy group showed significantly greater improvement than the control group. Prolonged exposure and interpersonal therapy also yielded significantly greater improvement in ratings of depression, quality of life, social functioning, and interpersonal problems. Comorbid major depressive disorder was present in half the sample, and it proved to be a striking moderator of treatment effects. In the prolonged exposure group, half of the depressed patients dropped out, compared to only 6% of those without major depression. Thus, interpersonal psychotherapy may have an advantage over prolonged exposure for patients with comorbid PTSD and major depression. Continuing the focus on psychotherapy, we'll turn to a brief cognitive behavioral therapy. David Rudd and colleagues examined the effects on suicide attempts in military service members with previous attempts or suicidal ideation with intent. These are among the most significant risk factors for death by suicide in adults. A common element of effective interventions to prevent suicide attempts is a focus on emotion regulation skills. But these approaches haven't been evaluated in active duty military personnel. Treatment in a military environment poses a number of unique challenges. Two primary requirements are flexibility and brief duration. This clinical trial compared standard treatment alone with standard treatment plus brief CBT. The participants were about 150 active duty soldiers. All of them had been hospitalized for suicidal ideation with intent or for a suicide attempt. Participants were randomly assigned either to usual treatment plus brief CBT or to usual treatment alone. Treatment as usual included individual and group psychotherapy, medication, substance abuse treatment, and/or support groups. The brief CBT was designed to include 12 individual psychotherapy sessions, weekly or biweekly. Upon completion of brief CBT, participants were allowed to choose whether they wanted to continue individual psychotherapy with another mental health provider. Brief CBT was delivered in three phases. In phase one, the therapist identified patient-specific factors in suicidal behaviors, collaboratively developed a crisis response plan, and taught basic emotion regulation skills, such as relaxation and mindfulness. In the second phase, the therapist applied cognitive strategies to reduce beliefs and assumptions that serve as vulnerabilities to suicidal behavior. In phase three, a relapse prevention task was conducted. Follow-up continued until 2 years after baseline. Suicide attempts were 60% less likely among soldiers who got brief CBT than in those assigned to treatment as usual. A significant difference between groups was observed as early as 6 months after baseline, and it increased in magnitude over the 2-year follow-up. When the analyses were repeated only for the participants with an actual previous attempt, the results again indicated that soldiers in brief CBT were significantly less likely to make a follow-up suicide attempt than those in treatment as usual. Participants in brief CBT were offered additional treatment during the follow-up, and 3/4 of them received more treatment. However, the group assigned to treatment as usual received a similar quantity of treatment. The only difference between groups in the amount of treatment during follow-up was the number of hospitalization days. Participants in the brief CBT group had significantly fewer days of hospitalization than those in the standard treatment group. Participants in brief CBT also had a somewhat decreased likelihood for medical retirement, 27 versus 42%, but the difference fell short of statistical significance. It's noteworthy that suicide attempts were reduced in the brief CBT group, but there were minimal differences in psychiatric symptoms over time. However, the primary goal of brief CBT is emotion regulation and development of problem-solving skills, as opposed to symptom reduction. The present results extend previous findings from non-military settings to military personnel. They indicate that these skills can be taught to suicidal military personnel in a relatively brief time and that inpatient psychiatric care can be reduced. In an editorial, John Curry examines the larger lessons of the study. First, he asks whether a treatment can have a major and specific impact on suicidal behavior without having differential impact on associated symptoms. The specificity of skill-based treatment for suicide risk isn't without precedent. A previous study of dialectical behavior therapy, including group and individual sessions, was also more effective than treatment as usual in decreasing suicidal behavior without showing a differential impact on depression, hopelessness, or suicidal ideation. Also, a form of cognitive therapy that specifically targets suicidal behavior in people who have made an attempt was also shown to reduce repeated attempts, even though it had no differential impact on suicidal ideation. However, it did show some effects on depression and hopelessness, and the degree of reduction in repeated suicide attempts was similar to the reduction in the current study by Rudd and colleagues. Beyond treating suicidal patients, the current study can help discern what contributes to effective psychotherapy. First, brief CBT is based on the common elements of the dialectical behavior therapy and cognitive therapy that have been effective for suicidal behavior. These include a clear model of the problem and treatment that's easy for patients to understand, agreement between patient and therapist on goals and strategies, targeting identifiable skills, having a crisis response or safety plan, and facilitating access to crisis services. Second, brief CBT emphasizes active learning of skills for emotion regulation and self-management. It allows a flexible duration and number of sessions, but requires mastery of suicide prevention skills. Such an approach moves the focus from what is taught to what is learned. Another important aspect of brief CBT is that it's designed as an adjunctive therapy. It allows the patient to continue receiving medication, other group or individual treatment, and involvement in support groups. These can address associated symptoms and diagnose disorders. Maintaining involvement in other interventions is likely critical to longer-term outcome. Social support itself is a protective factor in relation to suicide. Also, a number of disorders that can be addressed in longer-term treatment are risk factors for suicide. These include mood disorders, substance use, and impulse control problems. Our next study looked at the effect of pharmacological treatment not only for depressed women, but for their children as well. School-age offspring of mothers with major depression consistently have elevated rates of depression. Myrna Weissman and colleagues took advantage of a study comparing three different medication regimens to examine the effects on the children of mothers participating in the study. The children were 7 to 17 years old. They weren't excluded if they were in treatment, and they were referred for treatment if they or a parent requested it. The medication study was a comparison of escitalopram, bupropion, and combination of both medicines. The trial lasted 12 weeks. The overall rate of maternal remission was 67%, and it didn't vary significantly among the three medication conditions. Scores on the Hamilton Depression Scale also declined significantly. Depressive symptoms in the children were measured with a self-report measure, the Children's Depression Inventory. Scores decreased in two of the three groups. However, the child's improvement was related to the mother's only in the escitalopram monotherapy group. the children's functioning was evaluated with the child version of the Columbia Impairment Scale. During the mother's treatment trial, the scores for functioning improved among two groups of children. But in both cases, the children's improvement was not significantly related to reduction in the mother's depression scores. Possible reasons for the improvement in child outcomes in the escitalopram monotherapy group were investigated. Only the mothers in this group showed improvement in self-reported parental functioning. They reported being better able to talk to and listen to their children. Reports by the children paralleled these findings. The children in the escitalopram monotherapy group rated their mothers more highly on level of caring. These differential treatment effects could not be explained by dosage of maternal medication or side effects, or by the proportion of children who were receiving psychiatric treatment. However, the mother's level of negative affectivity at baseline did moderate the effects of escitalopram monotherapy. Children were also the focus of a study on cortical morphology and autistic traits. Previous research indicates that the social problems involved in autism spectrum disorder are part of a continuum of quantitative traits that extends into the general population. If this is true, then one would expect that the neuroanatomical aspects of ASD also lie on a continuum in the general population. Laura Blanken and colleagues examined this possibility in a population-based cohort of children. The participants were between the ages of 6 and 10 and were part of a larger study of child development. Autistic traits were measured with the Social Responsiveness Scale. More than 700 children completed the rating and had an MRI. On the basis of previous literature, the analysis centered on two features of cortical morphology that have shown differences in clinical samples of children with ASD, gyrification and cortical thickness. There were no areas where cortical thickness correlated with autistic traits. On the other hand, children with more autistic traits showed less gyrification in several regions of the brain, some in each hemisphere. In some regions, the relationship appeared to be driven by the children with more autistic symptoms. However, after excluding these children, the association remained present in a large cluster involving the temporal and precuneus regions of the left hemisphere. After about age 7, the children were also screened for ASD, and children with scores above a threshold were evaluated with diagnostic instruments. Only a small number received a diagnosis of ASD, and they were compared with age and gender match control subjects. The children with ASD had less gyrification and more autistic traits than the control subjects, although the effect did not reach statistical significance. This concludes our audio highlights of the May issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles, including author affiliations and financial disclosures. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psych.org. Next month, our topics will include patients receiving treatment for hepatitis C, cognitive behavioral treatment for adolescents with anxiety disorders, brain development in heavy drinking teens, a genetic variant associated with escalation of alcohol use in adolescents, combining citalopram and methylphenidate for geriatric depression, and the relation of cerebral small vessel disease to depression in the elderly. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.